Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. We have a fascinating show for you this morning. Our first guest is Chris Johnson, who's the director of the Scientific Computing and Imaging Institute and the distinguished professor at the School of Computing at the University of Utah here in Salt Lake. We'll be talking with him about the SCI, the Scientific Computing and Imaging Institute, which he founded 9 years ago and is now one of 8 permanent research institutes at the university and home to over 200 faculty, students, and staff.
And good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Our second guest this morning is David Epstein. He's the author of The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. This is a New York Times bestseller, and Epstein dispels in it many of our perceptions about why top athletes excel. He shows why some skills that we assume are innate, like the bullet-fast reactions of a baseball or cricket batter, they're not actually innate, and why other characteristics that we assume are entirely voluntary, like an athlete's will to train, might in fact have important genetic components. These two guests, plus today's cool story, when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, this is Jan Williams. KPCW is recruiting for the Volunteer Air Force. It's open enrollment for volunteer DJ opportunities. If you're interested in being a part of your community and KPCW, contact me, jwilliams@kpcw.org. The KPCW Volunteer Air Force wants you.
I'm Monica Simos with the Park City High School Minor Detail Show, informing you of current events at the high school and in the community every Saturday from 7 to 8 p.m. Tune in Saturday nights or listen online at kpcw.org and like our Minor Details Facebook page.
Brought to you by UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, and Todd Wakefield, attorney at law.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells, along with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning is Chris Johnson, director of the Scientific Computing and Imaging Institute, and also distinguished professor, School of Computing at the University of Utah, right here in Salt Lake City. Fusing advanced computing, simulation, and visualization with biomedicine has earned Chris Johnson a prestigious award from the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers Computer Society, IEEE. The Institute announced last week that it is bestowing the 2013 Sidney Fernbach Award on Johnson, a distinguished professor of computer science at the university, for his pioneer work in simulating anatomical structures such as the brain with high-performance computers, enabling medical research to improve treatment, hasten recovery, and continue unraveling neurological mysteries. Professor Johnson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah. Congratulations on your prestigious IEEE award. We certainly want to hear more about your work, but first I want to ask you about the institute you co-founded in 1994. Did you ever dream that it would be one of 8 permanent research institutes at the university and home to over 200 faculty, students, and staff?
Definitely not. Rob McLeod, who is a professor of bioengineering, and I started collaborating back in the early 1990s, we were young assistant professors, and I had one PhD student, and we were just trying to get our research group off the ground and had no idea of where it was going to take us and the number of people we would be able to work with, both here in Utah and throughout the world.
Yeah, and I mean, how does that make you feel?
It's very rewarding. It's kind of an amazing thing to walk into the institute now and see all these amazing people doing great research and great science, and it's a very fulfilling feeling of having all these great people around me.
Yeah, and you certainly don't stand alone as an island. How much collaboration do you do with the world outside of the university?
A tremendous amount. We have, I think, at least 60 different ongoing collaborations right now, and they are with groups both in the U.S. and throughout the world. So we have collaborations with people at Harvard Medical School, at Stanford University, at the Mayo Clinic, at the University of Stuttgart, at the University of Munster, at Oxford University, and many others.
Very good. Well, let's bring it home here to Park City, because, Chris, when I saw your photo, when I looked you up this morning, I went, this guy lives in Park City.
I actually don't live in Park City. I live in Salt Lake City, but I live up in the avenues in Salt Lake City.
Oh, you look very, very familiar. Maybe
Lynn really gets around.
Yeah.
Yes, well, it's also the case that there are a number of people named Chris Johnson that live in Salt Lake and Park City.
So. Yeah, no, it wasn't the name. I know a couple Chris Johnsons here in Park City, but it was your photograph. I thought that I've seen that guy around. Okay.
I have been to Park City. I've given some talks in Park City, and actually at the Kimball Art Center last year, we had a gallery exhibit called The Art of Science, where some of our visualizations were on display at the Kimball.
Oh, right. Okay, it's all coming together for me now. Great. Well, I was hoping to have at least a cursory understanding of exactly how it is that you come up with an algorithm that makes a computer model of what our organs do. Specifically, our brain is one of the things that you've been able to map. And that cursory understanding didn't really come to me. So maybe we can break it down to, do you teach any, 101 classes?
I do indeed.
And
so let me give you an example of a theme that is pervasive in our research, and it's creating patient-specific computer models, starting with images. So we would start with, for example, an MRI, a magnetic resonance image of a patient's head and brain. And from that set of images, so these would be these 2D scans that we would get of the head and brain, we would do a process where we would classify the different structures in the tissue. So the cortex and the cerebral spinal fluid and the scalp and the skull. And the way we do that is through a semi-automatic way. So we would create an algorithm that would teach the computer basically to find the edges of where the scalp is, or where the surface of the cortex is. And then from those classified images, we would then connect them together into computer models, so geometric models, so that we could create a patient-specific model based on those images. And once we had this geometric model, then computer model, and you can kind of think of it as like a CAD model, computer-aided geometric mm-hmm. design or something like that, except it's now a person's head or brain and based upon their scans, then we can do simulation and simulating electrical activity, for example, from epileptic seizures or other kinds of function. And that's actually one of the projects we work on, is trying to determine the source or the focus of an epileptic seizure. As it turns out, about 15% of children are not effectively treated with the epileptic drugs, the control epilepsy. And so one of the ways that they can be cured of epilepsy is if we can accurately localize where that seizure is starting for in the brain, and then they surgically remove that part of the brain, and if they do it successfully, then no more epilepsy. So we create these models of the head and brain and measure the electrical activity during epileptic seizures on the surface of the scalp, and then use our computer models to be able to go in and try to estimate where that seizure started from in the brain, and then give that information to the neurologists and the surgeons for their use.
Okay, so that really makes sense to me about mapping and creating a model, a 3D model and a CAD design. But what the gap for me is how you then can get into the neuroscience, into the neurology of the brain. I mean, I understand the electrical impulses, and wow, this is so hugely practical. The applications, with epilepsy, that is a huge advancement in science overall. But how do you measure the neurology?
So it's at multiple scales. So what I was describing would be at a macroscopic scale, where We would work with neurologists who would have a set of electrodes that they would place on the surface of the scalp. And, for example, there's a group we work at that is in Oregon that's called EGI, and they create a set of electrodes that there are 256 electrodes that go over that cover the head of the patient, and then they wear those electrodes, and for every millisecond in time, basically, they will record the electrical activity of the brain, and so some of that is normal electrical activity, and then sometimes they will record when the seizures are happening, and then we utilize that information spatially over the scalp, and then as a function of time to be able to try and localize where that seizure occurs. On the microscopic scale, we also work with researchers who are trying to understand the basic fundamental science of how those sets of neurons work and how they connect together and how they fire and how do they misfire, in a sense. And so we have a collaborative project with Gianluca Lazzi, who is in electrical and computer engineering at Utah, and as well as Ted Berger, who's a neuroscientist at the University of Southern California. And Ted works specifically on creating these computer models of sets of neurons and then tries to understand behavior of groups of sets under different places in the brain under certain different circumstances. And one of the real grand challenges of neuroscience right now and computational neuroscience is bridging that gap from kind of starting at the very bottom and moving up and then starting from the very top and moving down. So the mesoscale, as we call it, which is in between the micro and the macro, is really where there's a lot of interesting work going on that's not well understood at this moment.
Professor Johnson, I'm curious. You can point to the solutions that you provide or the tools that you provide and see the value that you add to these types of projects and problems. What are some of the unintended benefits that come from your products? For an example, creativity is sparked oftentimes when people see detailed pictures and analysis of things. Do you spark creativity from other groups by looking at your computer imaging?
Absolutely. And I think one of the really both interesting and rewarding parts of what we do is that in any new collaboration where we're working with domain scientists in biology or radiology or surgeons or physicists, we don't know the cutting-edge science in their field, and likewise, they don't know what the cutting-edge research going on in scientific computing and visualization. And so there's this this communication that has to happen where we, in a sense, kind of teach each other about our areas and fields and the problems that we have. And one of the things that happens often is that people will show people some of our research that's not in their area. It's in a different area, but they see it and they think, that's not what I do, but that's similar, or I could modify that, or that gives me an idea about something that we could do, and vice versa when we see some of the science where we haven't solved that particular problem, but we've solved one that might be analogous to that problem in another field, and we can adapt our tools, our algorithms, our software to be able to solve this other problem in another field. And so that actually happens on a regular basis, and it's really great. And it's one of the best feelings I get is when we work and collaborate with other scientists where we solve problems that neither one of us could have solved by ourselves, and that it really takes the expertise of the team to be able to solve the problem.
We're speaking with Professor Chris Johnson, Director of Scientific Computing and Imaging Institute, and also a distinguished professor at the School of Computing, University of Utah. Chris, I wanted to ask you, when you think about technological systems throughout history, at any moment in time during the last 30 years, there's always a bottleneck that slows development. Might have been computational performance, network throughput, lack of application software, lack of a certain tool. What is the current bottleneck for high-performance imaging? And if that bottleneck were removed, What sort of solutions do you think you'd be able to move towards?
So I think I'll make it a little bit more general and say that it's something that we all feel, and it's the tremendous amount of data that we are creating every second throughout the world, and the ability to understand and make use of all that data. I have a wonderful graph that shows how much data we're actually creating, and basically, it's if you think about the amount of data we're creating and how much data we've created over the 40,000 years of human history, we're creating every other day today the amount of data it took from 0 to 40,000 years in the past, just to give you a sense of how much data is out there. And it's in many different forms. It can be in these large-scale images. It can be in terms of genetic sequences. It can be Facebook connections and networks. And it's really the challenge, one of the grand challenges of our century, is to be able to make use of that data and to understand it and to filter it. And we use one way we attack that problem is through visualization, is the visual image processing of our brain. It takes up approximately half of our brains are used for image processing. And so one of our tasks as researchers is to find the right abstractions, the right mapping to some of this complicated large-scale data into something that we can recognize and understand visually. And so that's one of the big parts of our visualization analysis research, is finding those maps from all this complicated data out there and figuring out what's useful, getting rid of the rest of it, and then mapping it to something we can understand.
Yes, unfortunately, the marketplace is responding, as there are a number of big data type products out there where companies doing research, so that's exciting.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, the phrase big data has definitely caught on, and I think it's partially because we all feel it. It's not just in industry or in scientific research, but everybody who gets emails and has files and photograph collections and iPods and everything else.
Now, Chris, I want to stay kind of in this theme of marrying the knowledge between various fields. And you know, I'm going to make a sort of a stereotype of a scientist, or at least what a lot of us think of as, you know, scientists, and the way they think involves this very narrow mode. You know, they're very good at one thing. And so my question is about education in general. I mean, what you're in academia, what is going on in education, and maybe specifically at the University of Utah, although I'm sure it's happening all over the place, where people are really broadening their scope. And like you say, something that you've worked on, you have no idea that it can be applied in a completely different field. So what is happening to education that people's minds are expanding and broadening?
I think what we are seeing is a lot more education that is multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary, where you're really learning about more than one particular subject. At this point in time, it's mostly happening at the graduate level, at the master's and PhD level. We at the University of Utah have a number of interdisciplinary graduate degrees where you really do get a lot of breadth in addition to that domain knowledge. At the undergraduate level, there's also an effort to broaden the scope of the education as well, and in particular in the honors program that we have at the University of Utah. Just last week, I was invited to give a presentation in the interdisciplinary honors course, and the course was on creativity.
Mm.
And the faculty that were leading the course brought in researchers and academics from all over campus and basically asked them about what is it like to be creative in your field. And so there are philosophers and poets and physicists and computer scientists that come in from all over campus and discuss their own fields and the creativity that it takes to do research in their fields. And so I thought that was a fantastic class. I wish I could have taken that class when I was
Oh, Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm wondering for you personally, Chris, do you feel like the right side of your brain is suddenly, you know, sparked? Do you feel much more creative in your everyday, you know, interactions and dealings and even thoughts?
Absolutely. I feel that, you know, what we really do as scientists is creative problem solving. And the way I think about it is that, as you mentioned, many times people are trained just in one particular area, and I kind of think of it as a toolbox, so that they learn how to use a single tool really well. And my view is that the more tools you have in your toolbox, the better chance you have of approaching a problem and solving it in creative ways. So I think of tools as computational thinking is one way, but there's biological thinking and physical thinking and mathematical thinking and many, many different ways of approaching these problems in creative ways. And so I personally really enjoy learning about new ways to think about problems and new approaches, and I think it makes me a better problem solver overall.
Professor Johnson, if we could talk about cultural barriers. I was in high-performance computing and high-performance storage business. That was my career. Mm. And about, I think it was like 15 or 18 years ago, calling together on Harvard University and also with Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, we had a solution for radiologists. And the cultural barrier was that radiologists did not want to give up their film. They liked the tactile feel of the film and slapping it in the tray and those sorts of things. And they really were reluctant to grab this electronic imaging stuff. And slowly we got through that. Are there any other cultural barriers out there?
I think the answer is certainly yes. And the one you bring up, we have dealt with that too over the past 20 years of our careers. And one of the things that we found is that it really is generational, in the sense that the radiologists who you mentioned, they have been studying and working with two-dimensional films for 30 years of their life and training. And so they get very, very good at understanding and being able to find features in these two-dimensional films. Whereas if you then give them a three-dimensional digital version of this, they don't have that 30 years of knowledge and training. However, if you start the young people up and they've already come in where they're very adept at using computers and manipulating things in 3D, they catch on very quickly and are able to use it to really high effectiveness. And we see that a lot where there is this kind of generational change that is going on over time as the younger people who grow up literally with computers and iPads and iPhones from very young age, and they just feel very, very comfortable with that, with the technology. And so we see change after change of how computers and computation are being moved into different fields through these generational changes.
You know, we could talk to you all morning. This is fascinating. We want to thank you so much for being on our show. Cool Science Radio is a new show, and we'd like to have you back, Chris.
I'd love to come back, and thank you for having me today.
And congratulations again on your award.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And that was Professor Chris Johnson, Director of Scientific Computing and Imaging Institute, and also Distinguished Professor of Computing at the University of Utah.
When we come back, David Epstein, author of The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. That and today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly at 5:30 p.m. You can contact us at 649-3140. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host John Wells. Our next guest is David Epstein. He's the author of The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. Epstein dispels many of our perceptions about why top athletes excel. He shows why some skills that we assume are innate, like the bullet fast reactions of a baseball or cricket batter, are not, and why other characteristics that we assume are entirely voluntary, like an athlete's will to train, for example, may in fact have important genetic components. And we're happy to be joined now by David Epstein. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you on, and your book is a New York Times bestseller, getting rave reviews. Everyone loves the readability and the accessibility of the science in your book. So congratulations on that, first of all.
Thank you.
And, you know, I guess I want to bring up, you know, this very well-publicized book that Malcolm Gladwell wrote called Outliers. And many people read that and, you know, came up with the 10,000 hours that it really takes to hone your skill or your hobby or become a master.
Right.
And, you know, it goes back to that age-old question of nature or nurture. And there are arguments on both sides, of course, and I think you're going to make the argument more for nurture. But why does it matter, I guess, is my first question.
Why does it matter which one it is? I think it's because the way that people think about it actually influences the way we behave. I mean, for example, as that 10,000-hour rule has become increasingly popular, it's led to more what scientists call early hyper-specialization of athletes, so basically pushing kids into a certain sport and into very intense sort of professionalized practice very early on. And that actually runs contrary to what sports science shows works for most different sports and has led to a skyrocketing of injury rates as well for kids. So it really does change behavior, you know, what kind of messages people get about the sports science, and it changes the research that goes on. I mean, I found, you know, and I quoted in the book some scientists who said genes had gotten such a bad name because of sort of misreporting on them and people thinking that they are, you know, destined to do something, that they would leave the word genes out of their research proposals and use molecular biology and protein synthesis instead, even though it's the same exact thing. So I think it really does sort of have an impact where the rubber meets the road in the sports world.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, at what point can looking at genes and the, you know, the sequencing of the human genome, where is the most obvious contributor to athletic performance?
That's a great question, and it sort of depends what trait we're talking about. So one of the major themes of exercise genetics in the decades since the sequencing of the genome is that sort of just as medical genetics showed that because of differences in, for example, my version of a gene that's involved in acetaminophen metabolism from yours, my one Tylenol, you know, is more or less effective than yours, the same thing is holding true for training, that people are so genetically unique that any single training plan has a really different effect on any two different people. And so part of the way that talent is being redefined is this biological setup that allows you to profit from training more than the next person. So that's these trainability genes, some of which I was tested for in the reporting of the book, are really what are emerging. There's still a couple single genes I mentioned in the book, like involved in muscle growth and things like that, that have emerged as really important. But usually it's these networks of genes that allow somebody to adapt to the kind of training they're doing quickly.
David, through scientific studies, you report that on average, black athletes run faster and jump higher than white ones. And something we all sense, but we don't discuss because we're really sensitive about racial stereotyping. So first of all, congratulations for tackling a lightning rod issue. But the reason I bring it up is tell us about your findings.
Yeah. So actually, in the part of the book where I sort of depart from sports for the longest time is when I discuss what race does and doesn't mean from a genetic perspective anyway. And so to call kind of black athletes is a little coarse because there are certain things that they have in common. You know, the reason they have dark skin is because they have low latitude ancestry. So they have skin that protects against equatorial sunlight. But the West Africans who dominate sprint and explosion sports could not be more physiologically distinct from the East Africans who dominate long-distance running. So really, part of what I write about is how kind of useless just saying black is. That said, if we look at sprinting, for example, every man who's been in an Olympic 100-meter final since the boycotted Olympics of 1980 has been of recent West African ancestry, and from basically a small swath of the coast of West Africa. And that happens to be an area where people have, on average, a higher proportion of fast twitch muscle fibers, the kinds that you need for sprinting and jumping. That's just on average, not every individual, but it means that you're more likely to find, you know, the great outliers in those populations. They also have slightly longer legs, proportional to their body size, which is an adaptation to coming from low latitude and living in a hot and dry climate. The same reason that your radiator has long coils, to increase surface area to volume, to let heat out. And those are traits that all other things being equal are conducive to certain types of sports. Terrible for swimming and good for running.
Okay, so in all of this, you know, I'm wondering if in your research you found in some other part of the world that the anatomy and the physiology was very much the same as those in West Africa, but maybe you also found some sort of cultural genetic component that makes those athletes emerge and, you know, makes them able to train really hard.
Well, in some of the places there are, so for example, I mean, if you're talking about physiology that's similar to West Africans, I mean, Jamaicans are, they are West Africans, but they're not living in West Africa, and they, you know, they're like more people of that, way more people of that West African ancestry in the United States than there are in Jamaica, and yet Jamaica's kicking our butt in sprinting.
Uh-huh.
And that's, you know, when you go and see sort of what happens in Jamaica, the kind of funnel system that they have for sprinting talent, it's like college football in the United States. You know, what are the chances of, you know, many, many kids want to play, and what are the chances of a talented athlete in football slipping through the cracks in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Not very much. And that's about the same in Jamaica, where really the biggest event of the year on the island is the National High School Track and Field Championships. It packs a stadium of 30,000 people. There's shady boosters, you know, there are people bribing parents with refrigerators to get their kid to come to their high school. It's very reminiscent of sort of college football in the United States, both for good and for bad.
So the fact that they celebrate their runners helps out quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, think of Usain Bolt, for example. He was 6'4" when he was 15 years old, and with blinding speed.
Wow.
He wanted to play soccer or cricket. Those were his first two choices. In what other country in the world, I mean, and then a school principal sort of pushed him into track. In what other countries would a 6'4", speedy 15-year-old end up on the track? My contention would be Trinidad, Bahamas, maybe Barbados, and no others.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think there are others of him out there, but they're so much more likely to get identified and nurtured in Jamaica.
So that's where nurture plays into it also, but not necessarily bridging the gap into a genetic component.
No, I mean, and the interplay is really, you know, when you mentioned that 10,000-hour rule, I mean, one of the reasons I tell this story in the second chapter of these two high jumpers who, you know, the short version is one of them had practiced for about 20,000 hours and one of them about zero when he started high jumping on a lunchtime bet, and they meet at the World Championships, and the guy who just started actually wins. And so those guys had about 10,000 hours of practice on average between them, but it doesn't tell you much because one guy's zero and one guy's 20,000. And one of the reasons I wanted to tell that story was to show that even between two guys doing a very straightforward activity in the same sport, there's no blanket explanation. One guy came via a pretty extreme path of nurture and culture, and the other got lucky. And so there really is no blanket explanation, even in the simplest of sports.
How about the size of Donald Thomas's Achilles tendon? Did that contribute?
Yeah, that was Donald Thomas, the high jumper who sort of on a lunchtime bet realized he was world class and won the World Championships just a couple months after starting. And when he was examined, it turned out that he just has this tremendously long Achilles tendon, which is basically a spring in the back of your leg.
Uh-huh.
And the longer and or stiffer it is, the higher you jump. And he was just gifted with an Achilles tendon that should have been for a man much taller than him.
Ah, that's great. So sometimes it's almost a malformation or some little anomaly that you need to somehow recognize in yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, and sports are like the greatest petri dish for this kind of thing, you know. And some people have asked me, well, does it take out the joy of sports for you because you're finding some of these, you know, biological inputs to the things that athletes do? For me, not at all, because I never thought, you know, I never wanted to see identical twins race. I think it's a great display of human biological diversity to see, you know, a Michael Phelps who's 6'4", you know, walk into the stadium next to his countryman who runs the mile who's 5'9", and both guys are wearing the same size pants, you know, because those are the body types that are conducive to their sport. I think that's kind of a beautiful thing.
Let's talk about desire to win. Nobody wants to lose. Everybody would like to win or be a good athlete, but some really, really have a strong desire and are very motivated to train and to do the right things. I mean, that certainly fits in, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's a really, maybe the most surprising part of the book to me was that chapter 14, where I write about motivation. I sort of knew that researchers who study training and exercise know that physical activity alters the dopamine system in the brain, which is our pleasure and reward system. It sort of reinforces us for doing certain things, like exercising, for some of us. I didn't know that they know full well the reverse is true, that differences in our dopamine systems actually lead us to train more or less than the next guy. And that led to one of my favorite interviews in the book with ultramarathon legend Pam Reed. When I interviewed her, she had just finished the National Ironman Triathlon Championships in New York the day before, qualified for World Championships, and she's so uncomfortable sitting still that when I was interviewing her, she was flying out of LaGuardia Airport, and her flight was delayed. She had stashed her bags in a corner and was running laps around the parking structure while I was talking to her. You know, so that's an extreme example, but it's well known in exercise physiologists who study this that there are differences in our genetic makeup that leads some of us to have a compulsive drive to train. That doesn't mean, you know, I in some ways sort of regret using a quote from one of those scientists saying, you know, there absolutely are couch potato genes, because I think some people have interpreted that to say, like, whoa, well, I have an excuse. You
know? Yeah, there's nothing I can do about it.
No, that just means you might have to work a little harder to form your environment in a way that's conducive to you training than the next person. You don't get anything good out of saying, you know, well, I just don't have a choice. It's still up to you. It just might come easier to some people than others. It does.
Yeah. So it's funny. My sister has the couch potato gene, and I'm quite the opposite. I love competition. I enter all the races I can. And I have said to her, you just have to experience, you know, that dopamine release or, you know, endorphin or whatever it is. You know, as soon as you experience that, you'll be addicted. And so that may not be true.
It may not be.
Or it may.
it may or may not be. That's right. And that's a great word that you use, addicted, because, you know, in the mice that are bred sort of to mimic the dopamine system of humans in these genes, it's when they're bred for high, you know, a compulsive drive to train, they look exactly like what mice that are bred to be drug addicts are. It's just their drug is that dopamine rush, basically. So that's, you use the exact right language. It might be, it might not be, but that you have to get it over the hump first, you know. There might be all sorts of other factors, not liking the competition or not having been encouraged in certain ways. So it's complex, obviously.
David, tell us the story about Jenny Finch.
So Jenny was one of the best softball pitchers in the world. The 2004 gold medalist for the U.S. team. And one of the questions I really, you know, that motivated me for part of this book was I saw her in a game in 2003, a charity game, where all the other players were Major League Baseball All-Stars. And she was sort of pitched to them as like an exhibition. It was just sort of impromptu. She was just invited to be there as a ceremonial coach. And these guys, you know, they thought they were going to hit some home runs off her and have some laughs. And after a couple pitches, you know, she's facing some of the best hitters in the world. They can't even hit a foul ball off of her. And so suddenly, you know, I'm sort of wondering, well, and they're wondering too, because they didn't think this was going to happen. What's going on here? These guys, they have the reaction speed to hit 100-mile-per-hour fastballs, which take the same time to get to them, even less, actually, than the pitches she was throwing from a closer mound but at a slower speed. And it turns out that actually Major League Baseball players have the exact same reaction speed as teachers, doctors, lawyers. I scored faster on a reaction time test than Albert Pujols. He's one of the greatest hitters in history. And really, the way that they're able to do what they do, the humans don't have a visual system fast enough, capable of tracking a ball all the way in. Like, the advice to keep your eye on the ball is nonsense. You can't do it as it gets close to you. The only way you can accomplish that task is to pick up on cues like the shoulder movements of the pitcher or the flicker of the ball, which is the flashing pattern the seams make when it spins, that allow you way before you have to really react to predict where the ball is going. And that's the result of long, long practice in very similar circumstances. And when they're faced with unfamiliar body motions, unfamiliar spin of the ball, like Jenny was throwing, they're complete novices. They might as well be little leaguers. They're totally stripped of the things that allow them to do what they do.
That's fascinating.
And Rodriguez wouldn't even get into the batter's cage.
Yeah, I thought it was so funny, Alex Rodriguez, that he whispered in her ear, "No one's going to make a fool out of me," which is kind of funny now, right? Like, because he's always making a fool out of himself. But, he watched her pitch to the catcher, you know, who was used to the same things. He was used to the certain spin of the ball and the way the arm motion of an overhand pitcher. And so he missed a couple of her first pitches. And Alex Rodriguez just leaned forward and said, "Yeah, no, I'm not doing this on camera." You know, when she went to face Barry Bonds, he was talking a lot of trash, and after three pitches, he made the cameraman take the camera away. He wouldn't allow himself to be filmed anymore.
Exactly. Tell me this. Now, she's throwing around 65. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yeah.
And how far is the mound in softball away from the plate?
43 feet.
Okay. And pro, of course, is
60 feet.
60
inches.
Feet. 60 feet. Did that play into this at all?
Well, the transit time of the ball for the ball she throws is about equal to like a 94, 95 mile per hour fastball, which is absolutely quotidian for Major League Baseball players. So the reaction time is the same, but one of the cues, among the perceptual cues that baseball players pick up on that allow them to sort of anticipate the future, is how the size of the ball changes. That's one of the ways they gauge its speed, and they don't know this. But scientists who study them using sort of digital simulations and altering that information can figure out what they need. And so in that sense, it does. It does change the perceptual cue because the size of the ball starts different and changes at a different rate because they're watching it come from a different distance, even though the travel time, if anything, is slower than what they're used to.
And, David, for a 95-mile-an-hour fastball from the majors from 60 feet, how far is the ball from the pitcher's hand when the batter needs to make the decision to swing?
Well, you can't even initiate muscular action when the ball's halfway anymore. Halfway, it takes about 4/10 of a second for the ball to travel the whole distance, and it takes half that time just to start moving your muscles. So it's basically right out of the hand they have to start. And actually, if you ever watch a game and pay close attention, the batter sort of synchronizes the step of his front foot and the movement of his hands with the pitcher's windup, because if they didn't start well before the pitch, it would be way too slow. So they actually have to recognize where they think the pitch is going when it's almost just right out of the hand.
David, can you tell us about genetic testing and where you stand?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a lot of testing being marketed to parents, and most of it's nonsense. The most common test is for the ACTN3 gene, which codes for a protein only found in fast twitch muscle fibers. And, you know, if your kid doesn't have the so-called right version for sprinting, they're just not going to be in the Olympic 100-meter final. Like, that's just a fact. But that only rules out, like, 1 billion of 7 billion people on Earth, and you'd do a much better job of testing them by taking them to the park and having them race the other kids to figure that out. And so most of the testing that's being offered for performance it shouldn't be used, because it's like looking at one piece of a puzzle and you don't know, you know, the other 100 pieces, and you're trying to make a decision based on it. We don't know what all the other pieces are. So that testing is just marketing. The kind of testing that I do think has some value, but that isn't being marketed to parents, unfortunately, is for genes like the APOE gene, which we've known one version of it, APOE4. Since the 90s, we've known that it predisposes people to having Alzheimer's, and now it's emerged as important in all types of recovery from brain injury, like the kinds of hits that people take chronically in football. So people with that version of the gene, which is about 1/5 of people, and 2% of people have two versions of it, are more likely to suffer permanent brain damage if they play football or if they're a boxer. And that, I think, could be useful, but that one, unfortunately, isn't being offered to parents.
Wow, that's fascinating. You know, all the kids here in Utah, I believe it's now a state law that if they're involved in any type of sport, which most kids in Park City are, that they have to have a baseline test that so that if they get knocked in the head, you know, they can take the test afterwards. But many times they pass, you know, they get a little concussion or a big one, and they pass their baseline test while still suffering many, many symptoms. And do you know, if any municipalities, states, clubs, organizations are administering this test?
That's interesting that you mentioned that. I assume the test that they're probably taking is called Impact, or
yes,
some version of that.
It is Impact.
And it's interesting you mentioned that, because I think there's emerging research showing that 7 to 10 days out from a concussion, just about everybody, if it's a first concussion, will pass that test. But if they're given more difficult tests, like virtual reality balancing tests, they will fail. They are still symptomatic. So just like you say, it's, you know, it's better than nothing, but I think, you know, it's being sort of treated as like the ultimate gatekeeper in a lot of places, and I think that can be a little bit dangerous. You know, and the issue sort of with the gene I'm talking about is it, one of long-term effect, right? Like, so they're going to recover from the concussion at some point. But the question is, who are the people, and who are the people that, if they keep continue to do this, many years later are going to have really serious life-altering permanent effects?
Right.
And I don't think the testing is, there's doctors here and there who offer the testing. I've had it, but it's very rare, because the doctors I talk to would say, well, first of all, it's just statistical risk information, and that's hard for people to understand, which I don't really buy that argument, but. Because, you know, we tell smokers that they have whatever number of, you know, increased statistical risk of having a heart attack. And what doctors would tell me was, well, they can stop smoking. You can't change your DNA. I said, that's true, but you can change your environment. You could choose not to play football.
Right.
Or you could take fewer hits. So I just don't buy that argument, but it is, was the one put forward by most of the doctors I talked to.
Still, it's got to be hard to go and test your 8-year-old and find that they have likelihood for Alzheimer's.
That's another problem with it, and that actually I think is a more understandable argument, is that, well, you can't tell somebody about this risk information without also telling them about their Alzheimer's risk, and maybe they don't want to know, which is why I don't think it should ever be a mandated test. But in the studies where, you know, to see if people experience undue anxiety from getting bad news on that test, so far the signs have shown that people really are capable of handling it very well. And these are self-selected populations. They're people who volunteered for the test. But that's all I would ever think we should do anyway. I don't think it should be mandated, but I think it should, that awareness should be grown. So if people think it's something valuable, they could maybe take advantage of it.
David, you've written a fascinating book, and certainly wish you the best of luck. Before we let you go, let me just ask you one last question. What is next for you? What are you working on?
That's a great question. I actually just I just left Sports Illustrated recently, and I'm now at ProPublica, which is an investigative nonprofit in New York. And so I'm sort of reconnoitering and trying to figure out what to do next. You know, this book really represented my own deepest questions about the nature and nurture of athleticism. I took them as far as I could go with the currently available science. So I'm not sure. I want to find another project that I'm obsessed with. I'm in sort of a period of transition right now.
Well, obviously you found your niche in writing this book. I mean, I've seen nothing but just phenomenal reviews, so congratulations. And I want to ask you before you go, what was the most interesting thing that you found out about yourself and your own athleticism, because you got tested for all this stuff?
Yeah. To me, I think, well, so in one of the chapters I write about my own athletic experience, I was a national level 800-meter runner, half mile, and was a walk-on in college, and was paired with a really highly touted recruit who was a national athlete in Canada. And we would, you know, both come into the season, he'd be just killing me. And then we would do the same things, same exact workouts. And I would get much faster, I would catch up on him and eventually surpass him, and he would sort of stagnate. And so people sort of assumed that he was a quote-unquote head case and that I was just tough, you know. But we were doing the same, that we lived together, ate together, ran together. And when I was tested, you know, for this book, it turned out that I have a low aerobic baseline, meaning I start with poor endurance, and I have genes that predispose me to responding to that type of training really quickly. So it definitely made me reevaluate that sort of narrative. And now I think, you know, I was working hard, but so was he. I definitely wasn't any tougher than him. I think I, you know, my talent was trainability, and that was fortunate for the narrative that was bestowed upon me.
The book is The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. And David Epstein, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for your time.
The pleasure's been mine. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. And you're listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back with today's cool story.
KPCW presents Behind the Gold, a look back at Olympic history with host Tom Kelly. These stories are weekly every Monday morning at 8:30 and Friday afternoon at 12:30. Sponsored by Rosenberg, Cooley, and Metcalf Clinic at the Park City Medical Center and the Utah Olympic Park.
You're invited to Fun Friday Fall Fest every Friday at 9 a.m., where John and Jan poke a fun at the myriad of merriment to be had this fall.
Join us for our candy countdown.
Call in to win our candy quiz.
Fall Fest, Friday Fest,
October Fest. Brought to you by Wasatch Pub and Squatters Pub and Brewery.
All Seasons Adventures.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort.
And Foothill Oriental Rugs.
John, get out of the candy.
And we are back. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, and we want to talk about today's cool story. But first, I just bumped into Jan Williams, who is our extraordinaire program director and also co-host of Fun Friday. And tomorrow on her show, she has the folks from the home show, the Salt Lake Home Show. So sounds like a pretty interesting show. That'll be at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Now, experts from around the world gathered last month at the World Meteorological Meeting, and they discussed the number one thing on the agenda was to discuss powerful laser pulses can be used to generate changes in the atmosphere that influence the weather. So they can put intense pulses of light that can cause ice to form, water to condense. They can form clouds. They can manipulate the clouds to rain. And they've also proven that with these laser beams that they're able to take lightning discharges and trigger them and channel them through the air using these laser pulses. So, Lynn, it's pretty interesting stuff.
Okay, now they've been doing this since the 60s, right? They've been trying to manipulate weather. They used to do it by injecting silver something, iodide, something like that, into clouds and redirect hurricanes and all that sort of thing. But this is these lasers. This is the crux. This is a cool part of the story that it's new. It's lasers, new technology.
Well, that it's new, but also that it's very, very promising. And I'm not exactly sure how I feel. I mean, I think we ought to leave the weather alone. But of course, two thirds of the planet is water. So if you can get it to rain on land versus in the ocean, I guess that would be good for the arid areas that are going through severe droughts.
Yeah, and to break up the hurricanes that are going to hit, you know, hugely populated areas, save billions of dollars and lives.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And, you know, there's a rumor, although it's never been confirmed, and that's that the United States caused a premature monsoon season over North Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And, I mean, the DOD has never come out and said they actually did that, but I'm kind of concerned about what our military or other militaries will do with this technology.
Cool story. And you've been listening to Cool Science Radio. We want to thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Prudential Utah Real Estate, and the Spur Bar and Grill and 350 Main.
And join us next week for another edition of Cool Science Radio.
And we'll just thank this last underwriter before we go away and head into news.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. You've been listening to KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City. Time now for news.